Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And our focus, as always, is obtaining full compliance to the Constitution. If we're not going to hold our public servants accountable, they're going to run us off the cliff, as they've only proven that that's what they're going to do, because they don't care. They're getting rich and having a good time doing it. And that means that there's a lot of people that are unwittingly being a part of it because they're having a good time as well. They're making a bundle of money, and the problem, allowing the problem to persist, and the fact is, the problem is the goose that lays their golden egg. So with that, welcome back, Sean, and we are still going through the Constitutional Convention with James Madison. And I will probably, within the next day or two, get halfway through the document. But at this point in time, we're pretty close to, you know, getting through the expose of what's happening. I mean, the bulk of the real reading is up front, so we could see the different plans, how they kind of struggled through that process, and what really came out as some of the most the hurdles that the delegates had to overcome amongst each other, the differences that the states' paradigms were. Obviously, one of the huge differences was in economics, basically in regard to labor. There were states that didn't believe in slave labor and states that did. And when we, you know, and I look at that economically, because that was their paradigm. I mean, granted, we could say it's a matter of morality, but the process of slavery had been around for thousands and thousands of years. And granted, there's been awakenings and so forth where it has been undone and so forth, but, you know, usually that doesn't happen on its own. And as a matter of fact, I think I've shared already with you, the audience, if not once, twice, or maybe a few times, that historically there's only been two times where slavery was disbanded prior to the purpose of slavery. And what I mean by that is because there have been societies that enslaved their people. Like in India, the Taj Mahal. The building of the Taj Mahal wasn't done on free labor. And many of the great artifacts and feats that were done in that culture was not done on free labor. It was done on compulsory labor. In other words, they had slaves. It's the same thing as the Great Wall of China. If you look at all of the great historical feats of architecture and, you know, huge buildings and edifices created by man over the thousands of years, that just didn't happen. And it didn't happen because one or a few people decided they wanted to do that, because it would have taken them several lifetimes. If not, they'd still be working on it today, you know, like the Great Wall of China. So the fact is that slavery has been a part of, and as a matter of fact, as I mentioned in my first book, I'll just say this, that it was the first commandment that was really broken outside of murder, and outside of the commandment in the Garden of Eden, because the commandment of murder, I don't know if Adam and Eve were said, hey, don't kill each other. I don't know if they needed that type. They probably received everything they needed as far as the law and all of that. So that may have been in the sauce. But what they were told, and what the good Bible tells us, is that they were being cast out, that they must live moving forward by the sweat of their brow. They just can't walk through the garden and pick fruit and eat and, you know, live a carefree life. They are going to have to work for the rest of their lives, and that's how they are to sustain themselves, by the sweat of their brow. And therefore, when they decided, or I should say, their offspring decided to take their offspring and enslave them and have them, you know, toil by the sweat of their brow, they would live, then they really started defying that concept, because there's nothing more important as a parent and as a person that kind of goes through this in seeing people, you know, kind of in denial. There's no doubt in my mind that when we see this, we actually see people literally learning the most valuable lesson they possibly can, and that is the value of honest labor and an honest wage. That there's nothing greater for a person to be able to say, I did that, I'm making my own way, and this is a lost lesson. Our society today literally does not teach that. As a matter of fact, our education system teaches that you're entitled. And as a matter of fact, the paradigm is, regardless of your level of effort, regardless of your education and skills, you're entitled to a living wage so that you can live like everybody else. And that is evil. In other words, when we look at the two extremes, we're actually looking how slavery has been shifted. Slavery has been shifted to those who have the moral compass of trying to sustain themselves. And now they're paying the taxes and the wages for the indolent and the basically those who are, well, they're takers. They're consumers. They offer nothing other than a vote and a demand for more. Take more. We want more. And so if you kind of look at both sides of this, this kind of points to, I would just say, the divine lesson of self-sustaining, self-sufficiency, survival, and so forth on your own. Because if you can do those things, then you don't necessarily need government. And so why would you institute government? And then this is where the profound words of our framers basically said that governments are instituted by men, and the primary objects of government are to protect life, at least the government we create, protect life and protect private property. And we see today how, especially coming out of these legislative sessions, how more and more states are ramping up the seizure of private property. There's nothing that you have that they won't take. And they're at a point where they truly believe that they can take anything and everything as long as they need it, because the way they're spending money requires it. Folks, I can't tell you how often I say this in a social media forum or in public or what have you. We don't have a taxation problem. Taxation is necessary. It needs to be a part of every constitution, that there needs to be a way and mechanism of paying for the government that we have asked for them to give us. And that government that we've asked for them to give us is within the constitution. Ergo, we place in there the mechanism of taxation of how we'll pay for it. People have made huge mistakes by saying, let's just tax property. And actually, going through the notes on the convention, you can see that's what they kind of wanted to do. But instead, they kind of started settling on a generic tax per head. In other words, per person. That the tax would be levied to the state, and the state would figure out how to extract money for the requisition for the federal government of what they had to pay on that apportionment, or that apportionment tax, the direct tax, the things we're talking about right now in the convention. But today we're actually seeing where government is insatiable. They're spending, And in so doing, they're destroying your government. They're destroying your society. And nobody's holding them accountable because they don't have the authority in that constitution. They have the authority to tax you. But when they can't get enough out of the mechanism, then they'll come up with other ways to tax you. That's why they're doing this, because you're not holding them accountable to how they're spending your money. If they don't have the authority to spend money on labor, housing, and an abundance of things that they're spending money on, go look at your constitution. Folks, if I had the ability, I would take everybody's state's constitution and beat you about the heads with it. Because inside that, it tells you what you've authorized your government. And instead of reading it, you just complain. You just complain, oh, look at their taxation is theft. This is wrong, it's theft. Are you kidding me? It's the spending that is theft. The taxation is the mechanism of paying for the spending. They wouldn't need to tax you if you didn't let them spend on things they had no authority to spend on. So whose problem is it, and who is the problem? You're the problem. We're the problem because it is our job to keep them in the confines of that Constitution, which is why Madison said what he said. The authority of government comes from constitutions, and the sovereignty over constitutions is we the people. So in other words, we have to assert our sovereignty, say, hey, hold on here. You weren't created to do those things, to spend that money on those things. We don't care. Yeah, it's nice. You could save lives by doing that. But you need our authority to do that. You realize that. And because you cross that line, you're out. Now, you can come back to us, those replacements, and anybody can come back to us and say, can we do these things? And we'll consider it. That is the relationship. I want you to understand, we the people are, you know, we're not the sovereigns over the federal government directly. We're not the sovereigns over our state government directly. We're the sovereigns over our county government directly. And our county government is the first step in reaching down into the state and saying, look, you can't do these things. Because the people that created us to have us create you told us you can't do that. And we're seeing the truth in the Constitution. You don't have the authority to do that. Ergo, you got to stop or we're going to take you out. Not in the Italian sense, but in the constitutional sense. You will be banned and removed from public service, and you will live the rest of your life in shame because you have been removed and banned from public service, something we trusted you to do, and you defied our trust. So, anyway, I think I brought you back in, but I don't know if you had got a word in edgewise, because as you can tell, legislation, the time and the seasons, and actually everything that's going on, we've been warned about, and everybody is just out there having a good time. As a matter of fact, I'll end with this. It alarms me to see so many patriots living in artificial intelligence, working with artificial intelligence in creating their own books and their own ideas and so forth. Like, you know, artificial intelligence is giving us the foolproof way of being able to secure our liberty and so forth. No, actually what you're doing is you're teaching artificial intelligence these processes that they will report via their intelligence collection of the threats, so that those people who are managing those collection apparatuses, your artificial intelligence, will be able to come to you and somehow take you out in the Italian sense, if you know what I mean. Anyway, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
Yes, sorry about the long monologue.
But no problem.
I'm sure that in the state of Louisiana, you probably deal with the same thing. They want more money. They want more money. They need more money. In some of the states, though, in the blue states, if you live in a red state, you need to start looking at what's going on in blue states, because it's quickly coming to you. It is quickly coming to you. So anyway, we left off in Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, where they were kind of talking about admission of new states and property and representation, because it's all entwined. It's all entwined. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I'll just say, it becomes very important for the federal government to start promoting and getting new states into the union. They want to make sure that they secure the territory that they got out of the Versailles or the 1783 treaty with Britain, which was the treaty of the Northwest Tort Ordnance Area, or I should say in the Northwest Treaty. That territory up there in the Northwest area was a large area. I think it went up to, I think, Michigan, and over to Illinois. And Minnesota was further to the west. But that area was secured in a treaty, but it wasn't secured because at the time, as the Constitution was being fomented and ratified, the Indians were being coerced and actually being paid off, I should say, or manipulated by Britain to try to harass the American settlements. The French were trying to get and secure property as well in the Western Territory. They realized that, you know, that was all open, you know, all up for grabs. So we'll get into the kind of the early days of government where they talk about the need of securing the Western lands and why they have to, you know, kind of put the admission of states forefront so that they could start securing that land and continuing on. And as they started securing the land, it kind of begot the, I don't know if you want to call it the spirit or the motivation, whatever you want to call manifest destiny. As a nation, we started realizing that the more land that we could secure, the less potential we would have of having to fight and compete for land that was, at this point in time, for the taking in our paradigm. Because even though there may have been inhabitants on that land, those inhabitants could have actually, it could have easily been, I'll just say, woven into our society. The framers were pretty adamant about in basically making them a welcomed member of our society to try to figure out, you know, how, and they were doing that, as a matter of fact. The Cherokee Indians were doing a great job in becoming a productive, I'll say, a community in the South where they were beating the South at their own game. So anyway, long story short, we are going into the land, the admission, property, representation, and we just finished with Mr. Gary of Massachusetts comments. And so let's pick it up with on the motion of Mr. Randolph. Go ahead.
On the motion of Mr. Randolph, the vote of Saturday last authorizing the legislature to adjust from time to time the representation upon the principles of wealth and numbers of inhabitants was reconsidered by common consent in order to strike out wealth and adjust the resolution to that requiring periodical revisions according to the number of whites and three-fifths of the blacks. The motion was in the words following, quote, but as the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, that the legislature of the United States be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives, and in case any of the states shall hereafter be divided or any two or more states united or new states created within the limits of the United States, the legislature of the United States shall possess authority to regulate the number of representatives in any of the foregoing cases upon the principle of their number of inhabitants according to the provisions hereafter mentioned.
Okay, so what is there anything that you just read that really stood out? Because I've talked about this, and they mentioned it twice here. Anything. That's okay. It's okay. So in the very first line, it basically says that on the motion of Mr. Randolph, the vote of Saturday last, authorizing the legislature to adjust from time to time the representation upon the print. So that part right there, the adjusting the legislation of representation was being given to Congress. The language was in the Constitution that Congress would have the ability to adjust the number of people they were to represent. That was right there in Article 1, Section 2. It's not there now. So we're looking now halfway through July almost, where the concept was still, you know, prevailing that Congress would have this authority to be able to determine how many people they would represent. They hadn't had that argument yet, and they hadn't had the epiphany, we can't trust Congress because they will make that number to where they marginalize, you know, a person's voice and, you know, basically drown everybody out into this large sea and create an oligarchy out of Congress. And even though when you look at 435 people, we're not talking about, you know, a few hundred thousand. We're talking about 300 and some million. And we're looking at basically one representative representing a million people. It's almost like governors or kings, because when you look at some nations, there's plenty of nations that are under a million. I mean, there's plenty of small nations out there where the president. And so Congress is wielding that kind of power? We'll get to it, but there's another part of this. It says down a little bit below, when the little quotation, quote, but as the present situation of the states may probably alter in the number of their inhabitants, that, again, the legislature of the U.S. be authorized from time to time to apportion the number of representatives. They're laying it out, folks, that they actually were giving this power to Congress, and it's not there. So when you read this, don't think that this is how the Constitution was designed. They had some serious arguments about this, because this is the language. This is literally the language. That's why it says, quote, but as the present situation of the United States, this is what they're putting in the Constitution, that they would have the authority to make these changes. It's not there anymore, folks. They got to their senses and said, you know what? We think the people ought to be the best to decide, because they're one of the reasons that they wanted to, you know, be kind of cautious in creating this government was they wanted to make sure that the government wouldn't get costly and become a huge burden to the people. So part of that was, how many people were we going to employ? If you had one person that represented 10 or 100, that would be a pretty sizable government, very huge, which means that it would have been probably very costly. They wanted to make it, you know, what was palatable in the cost. And as we saw, and as it kind of moved forward, we could see that they created a government that was large enough to adequately represent people, but not necessarily aggrandize and amass power in Congress. And secondly, not to overcome the people in the cost of government. Okay, so now let's go ahead and dive into Mr. Governor Morris. Because I'm only pointing out these things that are huge, folks, when we're reading the language, because this is all literally the suspects of paradigms that were not maintained, but they're carried today because Congress truly believes they have the authority to change that number of how many people they represent. They were never given that, and it required an amendment. And we've proved this every year that there was an amendment made that would allow that. We'll be right back after this message.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I mean, you were about to read, and I don't know if you noticed, because we were heading right into a break, and I didn't notice it until I made an extra comment and the music came into my ears. So anyway, kind of caught, but not blindly caught. Anyway, let's go ahead and pick this up. As a matter of fact, I think, Sean, you're going to notice that there's a lot of debate that goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It is so consuming of their time of trying to defend getting the slaves as property as well as representatives or inhabitants and what have you, how they're trying to classify them so that they can get full count of representation. So anyway, go ahead and let's pick up with Mr. Governor Morris.
Mr. Governor Morris opposed the alteration as leaving still an incoherence. If Negroes were to be viewed as inhabitants and the revision was to proceed on the principle of number of inhabitants, they ought to be added in their entire number and not in the proportion of 3/5. If as property, the word wealth was right and striking it out would produce the very inconsistency which it was meant to get rid of. The train of business and the late turn which it had taken had led him, he said, into deep meditation on it, and he would candidly state the result. A distinction had been set up and urged between the northern and southern states. He had hitherto considered this doctrine as heretical. He still thought the distinction groundless. He sees, however, that it is persisted in, and that the southern gentlemen will not be satisfied unless they see the way to open to their gaining a majority in the public councils. The consequence of such transfer of power from the maritime to the interior and landed interests will, he foresees, be such an impression of commerce that he shall be obliged to vote for the vicious principle of equality in the second branch in order to provide some defense for the northern states against it. But to come more to the point, either this distinction is fictitious or real. If fictitious, let it be dismissed and let us proceed with due confidence. If it be real, instead of attempting to blend incompatible things, let us at once take a friendly leave of each other. There can be no end of demands for security if every particular interest is to be entitled to it. The eastern states may claim it for their fishery and for other objects, as the southern states claim it for their peculiar objects. In this struggle between the two ends of the Union, what part ought the middle states in point of policy to take? To join their eastern brethren according to his ideas? If the southern states get the power into their hands and be joined as they will be with the interior country, they will inevitably bring on a war with Spain for the Mississippi. This language is already held. The interior of the country, having no property nor interest exposed on the sea, will be little affected by such a war. He wished to know what security the northern and middle states have against this danger. It has been said that North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia only will in a little time have a majority of the people of America. They must, in that case, include the great interior country. and everything was to be apprehended from their getting power into their hands.
So what do you think? And the one thing that jumped out, I could ask you, but this is really a nuance, because he actually throws out that his mind has shifted. He is no longer challenging the concept of equal representation to secure a balance between the legislatures by ensuring that the Senate be equally divided amongst the of the states. And this is what he says, that he, this is his comment, he says that he shall be obliged to vote for the vicious principle of equality in the second branch in order to provide some defense for the northern states against what they're talking about, and giving the South this equal apportionment for slaves, even though they don't have representation. In other words, it's giving those who do have power more power. And he's calling, you know, he's calling it out at that. And as he basically says, if this goes forward where they can obtain that kind of power, then we need to have something. And so, as he says, it's changed his mind to say, you know, even though I wasn't in favor of this equal suffrage in the state, in the Senate, the second branch, he's now in favor of it because we need to have something that keeps this democracy from allowing the power shift to literally go into the southern hands, because they will become insatiable in driving and gaining more land and driving the northern states to have to fight wars. So Mr. Butler of South Carolina, because he obviously is in favor of, you know, the southern states having that power, basically makes his comments. So go ahead with him. And so you may be muted because it looks like you're probably muted, but let's go ahead.
Mr. Yeah. Butler, the security the southern states want is that their Negroes may not be taken from them, which some gentlemen within or without doors have a very good mind to do. It was not supposed that North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia would have more people than all the other states, but many more relatively to the other states than they now have. The people and strength of America are evidently bearing southwardly and southwesterwardly.
Okay, because the further south you go in the United States, the more easy it is agriculturally, because you don't have the harsh winters of the north. I mean, you know, we're just getting through winter, and you could see how, you know, across the middle of the United States to the north, from east to west, you know, across the middle of the states that way, on the north side, it gets pretty cold. And so the agricultural years are shortened. You can only be so productive and so forth. So, yeah, the reality is, and as a matter of fact, I think it was Montesquieu. The Spirit of the Law. I think Montesquieu wrote a book called The Spirit of the Law, and he talks about the propensity of people to live closer to the equator because it doesn't challenge them. You know, there's no challenges in parts of the year like a winter for, you know, them to have to work harder to survive, because you only get a few months to work, and then because you have to store away energy and all that stuff to stay warm and make it through the winter. And so he basically identifies that the societies in the southern latitudes are very lazy, and that they, because they don't have to work as much and as hard, and that, you know, he talks about their lifestyle and so forth. And the book is called The Spirit of the Law, and I think it was Montesquieu that wrote that. But anyway, it's kind of insightful because it is where the industry is. Well, if you're not doing the work and you actually have plantations, and you're literally driving mass production, mass production, mass production, because why? Your profits go up. Like I said, slavery and the plantations were America's first franchise, where it became very profitable for people to amass power and affluence, even though George Washington was, but he was a slave owner. And with his wife and him, Martha, they became very prominent. We just talked about that. And so they were kind of in the South, but the further South, it was, they were far more driven. And so actually your comment yesterday, I think it was yesterday, in speaking, or maybe it was the day before, that you were commenting on how, you know, the average slave owner is really thinking profits and business, making business decisions. I will tell you that that was the paradigm of the South. And it was a business decision to secede because they weren't about to give up, you know, their mass profits by giving up slavery. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't even about slavery. The Northern aggression, even though it was kind of all pointing that way, and when they seceded, they pointed to slavery. But they decided that they would rather leave the Union, in other words, instead of having to face the potential of giving up their slaves. And that literally, it was a business decision. It wasn't a moral decision at all. Actually, I would say, and I think you'd agree, Sean, it was an immoral decision so that they could protect their institution of slavery. So, Mr. Wilson of Pennsylvania, another state that looks down, as a matter of fact, Pennsylvania was one of those states that really abolished and did not practice slavery, one of the early states that weren't really practicing it, where there was the lowest population, I think, that had slaves. Go ahead with Mr. Wilson's comments.
If a general declaration would satisfy any gentleman, he had no indisposition to declare his sentiments. Conceiving that all men, wherever placed, have equal rights and are equally entitled to confidence, he viewed without apprehension the period when a few states should contain a superior number of people. The majority of people, wherever found, ought in all questions to govern the minority. If the interior country should acquire this majority, it will not only have the right, but will avail themselves of it whether we will or no. This jealousy misled the policy of Great Britain with regard to America. The fatal maxims espoused by her were that the colonies were growing too fast and that their growth must be stinted in time. What were the consequences? First, enmity on our part, then actual separation. Like consequences will result on the part of the interior settlements, if like jealousy and policy be pursued on ours. Further, if numbers be not a proper rule, why is it not some better rule pointed out? No one has yet ventured to attempt it. Congress have never been able to discover a better. No state, as far as he had heard, had suggested any other. In 1783, after elaborate discussion of a measure of wealth, all were satisfied then as they are now that the rule of numbers does not differ much from the combined rule of numbers and wealth. Again, he could not agree that property was the sole or the primary object of government and society. The cultivation and improvement of the human mind was the most noble object. With respect to this object, as well as to other personal rights, numbers were surely the natural and precise measure of representation. And with respect to property, they could not vary much from the precise measure. In no point of view, however, could the establishment of numbers as the rule of representation in the first branch vary his opinion as to the impropriety of letting a vicious principle into the second branch. On the question to strike out wealth and to make the change as moved by Mr. Randolph, it passed in the affirmative.
So based on the arguments, and you could kind of see how they're exposing both the admission of states, if they're not coming in with equal sovereignty, and we actually oppose, you know, hold them back and oppress them, then it basically lends to the revolution. I mean, they were kind of like real, as they were moving forward as children, trying to create a system that would benefit them, they realized that they couldn't create a system that would just benefit them, and that would last. that the only way that they could create a system that would last, you know, as a permanent solution of governing, it had to benefit everybody. It had to benefit the states, the state cultures. It had to benefit the people. Everybody had to benefit. And that's why they started backing out on some of these ideas. Now, we go a little bit further because now they start talking a little bit more about admitting new states. And see, most people wouldn't think. And as a matter of fact, when you go through the ratification debates, guess what they don't talk about? There's hardly any mention of new states joining the Union, or at least they don't mention the constitutional process of how states are to be admitted, because it becomes just basically, you know, shoot, that makes sense. You know, giving them a disadvantage would just create war down the road. Letting everybody come in and be an equal benefactor, as well as a, you know, a equal responsibility of the burden of our successes and so forth, it just makes sense. That's why they didn't challenge Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution on Congress's process of how they laid Congress's process or responsibility in admitting new states into the Union. Most people think that Congress had the power to do that. No, they were the stewards for the Union in growing the Union to allow new states to be formed out of territories and nurture them and develop them so that they could become full sovereign states. In other words, the child became the babysitter and the nurturer, the educator, the developer, so that this territory could then become a full sovereign state with the rest of the adults in the Union and become a part of the ring of masters over that child. That's why, when you really look in the second paragraph of Section 3, the power to make rules and regulations respecting the territory ended there. When the state became a state, they had no power or authority to mandate how that state would become a state, nor, you know, how they had to form or any of that kind of criteria. They started waking up and going, you know, we could probably do this and nobody would challenge us. So anyway, let's go into Mr. Gary of Massachusetts.
Mr. Gary wished before the question should be put that the attention of the House might be turned to the dangers apprehended from Western states. He was for admitting them on liberal terms, but not for putting ourselves into their hands. They will, if they acquire power like all men, abuse it. They will oppress commerce and drain our wealth into the Western country. To guard against these consequences, he thought it necessary to limit the number of new states to be admitted into the Union in such a manner that they should never be able to outnumber the Atlantic states. He accordingly moved that in order to secure the liberties of the states already confederated, the number of representatives in the first branch of the states, which shall hereafter be established, shall never exceed in number the representatives from such of the states as shall accede to this confederation.
Okay, so again,
it's amazingly ironic to me how
ahead.
He says they will acquire power like all men abuse it, so we have to abuse them first.
Yeah, so so you know, it takes time to get people to kind of give up or realize that there, you can't win with this argument. You just can't win. Because as he points out that, you know, they're going to grow, he thinks that they'll become amassing the, you know, so let's look at history. And if you really look at the world history of mankind, show me where you have this in a nation, the great powers and the great cities and the amassing of population right in the middle of the hinterland, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the coasts where commerce and the flow and exchange, you know, of species, commodities, all of those types of things are occurring on a daily basis. I mean, when we kind of look, you'll notice that in Europe and in Asia, you know, the only reason that there's a huge city in the interior is because there's a huge river right there. So when you look at America and you go up that Mississippi and some of these other rivers, you go, okay, that makes sense. You've got some population centers there. But let's go to the west of that. Show me how huge cities became and amassed huge cities. The only city that actually became a big city that was east of the Rocky Mountains to the Mississippi was Denver. And that, if you've heard my theory on that, Denver became a massing of people that were tired and too lazy to go over that continental divide. When they got there and they saw the magnitude of those mountains, they go, this looks like a good place to live. In other words, Denver became the town, and they should have named it properly so it was literally, you know, a word for, you know, quitters. Because that's why people stopped and stayed. They saw that when people were coming, and because apparently that's where the trail to the Oregon territory as well as over to California, unless you really wanted to go close to Mexico and, you know, those tribes and everything to the south, this was the way everybody was going to the West Coast. And so Denver was created from all the people that were too broke, too busted, too tired, just they quit. And that's how Denver got there. But that's the only reason why it became a large city quickly, because if you look at all the other states, you know, none of them had anything like Denver. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So it history only proves, and we can see today, you can actually look it up. You can find out that the world's population lives within 250 miles of the coastline of the continents. In other words, when you go inside the 250 miles into the interior of all the continents, you will find less, you know, 10%, 15%, something like that. There's that many people that live close to the water because that's where the commerce is. That's where the trades is, and the you know, that's where, you know, your work becomes valuable. You know, the more you have to struggle in moving your perishable commodities from the interior, by the time you get it to the coast, it's already perished. Your milk's gone bad, or what have you. Even though in today we have refrigeration, those types of things to accommodate that, the settlements were already, the trends were already set that you wanted to expand, you know, into the, I'll call it the suburbs of these cities. And that's where the food, the dairy farms were. And everything out in the wide open was, you know, cattle ranches and the Western style of life in America and however the cultures were in other nations. But nevertheless, I digress. Mr. King seconded the motion. So Mr. Sherman then says,
Mr. Sherman thought there was no probability that the number of future states would exceed that of the existing states. If the event should ever happen, it was too remote to be taken into consideration at this time. Besides, we are providing for our posterity, for our children and our grandchildren, who would be as likely to be citizens of new Western states as of the old states. On this consideration alone, we ought to make no such discrimination as was proposed by the motion.
There you go. And as a matter of fact, he was right. A lot of the people that moved west were the children because, you know, if in those days, guess what? They had big families. The reason they had big families is, one, the infant fatality rate was high. You didn't know if you were gonna, you know, if that child was gonna die, so you went and, you know, started to have another one, because if that child did die, because you needed children to help survive, and so those children help survive, and then when you pass on your estate, you can only pass on your estate to so many children. you know, giving out as much as you possibly can, but the property's only going to go to one. So what is the rest of them going to do? Well, they're going to move west, where it's cheaper to buy land, where it's easier to get started and start anew. So that was the propensity, that was the trend, and that's why Manifest Destiny really started driving people to the west. And so they were all gung-ho until they got to Denver. I'm sorry. So Mr. Gary then says this.
If some of our children should remove, others will stay behind. And he thought it incumbent on us to provide for their interests. There was a rage for immigration from the eastern states to the western country, and he did not wish those remaining behind to be at the mercy of the immigrants. Besides, foreigners are resorting to that country, and it is uncertain what turn things may take there. On the question for agreeing to the motion of Mr. Gary, it passed in the negative.
Okay, so now we can just skip down a little bit, skip to our Lou, and go down to page 184, where Mr. Madison then broaches this topic of admission of new states and representation. So if you just kind of scroll down, it's a bit down. It's actually, it's towards the end of the day.
I have it.
Okay. So we've got less than a minute, and you can kind of see that this is a long one. So what we'll do is we will earmark this and start here next time we do one. So this gives you, you've read quite a bit. So I'm sure you have a few comments on what you've read and, you know, the insights that these men had or the limitations of insights that they had and how over time, I think the spirit of equality, the spirit of individual opportunity, individual liberty, individual sovereignty, that the spirit that created America really was the prevailing spirit of the of this convention, that over the course of the 4 months that these men were conscripted or sequestered, however you want to call it, where they were dedicated to solving this problem. I don't think that there was any point in time where, you know, the Articles of Association or the Articles of Confederation were created in such a manner that this is all you do. You're going to solve our problem. You're going to go, we're putting you aside for a few months, and you're going to be in this room with a bunch of others and solve our problem. Because that they didn't have the luxury of doing that. I kind of started this whole reading off with this very unique thing we call the Constitutional Convention. So anyway, any comments, any points, what have you?
No, sir.
No go-backs? Nope. Because obviously, whatever.
That time.
Okay. I understand that. We can do go-backs in our next session, which is fine with me. So as we go through this and as I kind of look ahead, you're going to notice that there's very, very little that we're going to cover in the next probably few days of, you know, the notes and so forth. And you'll actually see that there are long days ahead where there's lots of people talking. In other words, the body of the whole is really debating more and more some of these ideas that are coming from the committees. And this is where they're flushing these things out. Folks, as we give you the truth, we're just proving that we need your help. On GR Mobley, we're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review as well as my description of the Republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.